Okay, well, welcome back. So are there any announcements? One thing that I would like to remind everybody of, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago about putting together a set of climate literacy sessions for the AGU meeting. Right now we have about 6 sessions, and I'm really right now just trying to identify people who are interested in being conveners of those sessions. This is not, at this point, is not to present your own work, but to help put together a session around a particular content area, and the sessions right now are K-12 is one focus, higher ed's another focus, informal and community outreach, this would be a third focus, one's on research and evaluation, one is on misconceptions and how we know we're making progress, and is that 5, and then there's one more, and I can't think of it at the moment.
Yeah, it's one Mark mentioned, I think.
Right. I think there was one other in addition to that. Anyway, if anybody is interested in being a convener and helping us put together these sessions, we'll put together groups of 4 people to be a convener of each session, and that group of 4 people will refine the title so that it's not just bland content area, but represents what they'd like to bring to the session, and they'll create the abstract, the description of the session, and submit it. And then what the convening group does is once the abstracts get submitted to a session, they will organize a session in terms of deciding which they'll invite speakers, and they'll also organize the order of the presentations and who is an oral session and who's a poster session. So, and in that process, you can submit your own abstracts to the sessions too. So you ultimately be able to submit abstracts to present your own work. But right now we're looking for conveners that can sort of think about that broader picture of what we'd like to have presented at the AGU meeting with respect to climate literacy. So send me emails if you're interested in being a convener.
Rather remarkably, I think the NSTA deadline for 2013 is something like 2.5 weeks away.
Right. So. That's true. Yes. The meeting doesn't start until later this week. A number of us are going to that. We have actually a very good representation of the Climate Literacy Network at the NSTA meeting. I think we have we had to reduce the font size to include everybody on a 1-page flyer, all the presentations around climate literacy. But that's later this week, and then as Don said, the deadline for next year is in a couple of weeks. And just also a reminder, the NAAEE session proposals, which these are for presentations around particular areas, you know, your particular area of work, those are due on April 26th, I believe. 25th.
Okay. Yeah.
And there are other announcements?
And Tamara, uh-huh. There's a new announcement out about that, and I will forward that to everybody later today.
Okay, great. Thanks.
This is Alan in Berkeley. I have an addition to the NSTA. There, the Lifelines for Climate Change Education project, that NASA grant project, is going to have an in-person meeting there at NSTA, which we didn't know about till a couple weeks ago. And that I can send it out by email where it is. Anybody can drop in.
So you're inviting everybody who's there to come?
Well, anybody can drop in. I don't know.
Okay.
It's for Lifelines PLC members and leaders, but anybody who's interested could come there. It's from 11 to 1 on Friday, March 30th, in the Florida Room at Marriott downtown. I'll send that out by email.
Okay. I'll also send the flyer out by email to the Climate Literacy Network, but we've printed out flyers that we've just actually shipped yesterday. I'd like to get them at various booths and especially the early presentation, so that people that come by will be able to take a look at and follow up on other climate related sessions.
By the way, that meeting we've also set up it to be a telecon, so people who can't be at NSTA can also come to that meeting by telecon.
Well, that'd be great, Alan.
Okay, are there any other announcements? Okay, if not, then we'll move on to our presentation today. As everybody knows, we're really excited to have Dr. Richard Alley present us this afternoon, or at least for us on the East Coast this afternoon. Richard Alley is a professor at Penn State University, and he's participated on the UN IPCC committees. But what most of us know him for is his efforts in communicating about climate change. He's been done research and communicated about climate change ranging from Antarctica to Greenland, and has quite a few publications, over 200 scientific publications. He has been elected to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and is the featured host of Earth, the Operator's Manual Project, and he's going to talk to us today about Earth, the Operator's Manual Project, Good News in Unexpected Places. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Richard.
Well, thank you. It's thanks for having me. It's so fun to hear all the good things you're doing there, and I always look forward to the education sessions at AGU, so I'm glad to see people stepping forward for that. At any rate, if you have my slides up, I hope you're looking at a really big iceberg, and we're not going to stay on the really big iceberg long, but at any rate, that one's one in Greenland. If you click to the next slide, number two, this is the obligatory promotional shot. We have 3 hours of TV, and they should be out in your local PBS affiliate late in April. Check your local listings. PBS is not monolithic, and when they say they're going to do something, a few of the big markets sometimes do their own thing. So at any rate, check your local listings, but there should be 3 hours out. The first hour was shown last year, and the next two will be coming, and there's also a book that's sitting up there. If you click the next one, slide three here, you should see Jeff Haynes-Stiles in the upper left there. Jeff's the director, the writer, the head of the project, and so on and so forth. And he's sitting there on a boat on the lake on the toe of the Tasman Glacier. When I first saw the Tasman Glacier, he would have been under the glacier, and now you'll notice he's out way in front of the glacier. And he's been joined in making this happen. Lower left there is Erna Kuganow. I don't know if Erna really loves the picture of her with the camel, but I love the picture of her with the camel. So at any rate, that's down in Morocco, and that's me sitting in front of the Pacific Ocean at Big Sur in the upper right. So like I say, we hope to have 3 hours of TV on your station, but most stations will have it. The one here locally is doing it on Ardent Earth Day. So at any rate, if you click forward, I'm going to walk you through some pieces of Earth, the Operator's Manual. Some of these are things that we show in the first or second or third hour. Some of them are things that sort of feed into it. But if you're looking at slide four here, it really is useful to start with the recognition of how much good we do get from energy, how important it is to us, and what a big, important, interesting task it is to fix that somehow. So this one has... You've probably seen this, but if not, the cartoon in the upper right is a real editorial cartoon that really was published in Vanity Fair in 1861, and it shows the oil wells of our native land. May they never secede. Oil's well that ends well. And, you know, the people were really happy when they got the oil wells of Pennsylvania. There is, on the lower left there, is the history of whale oil production in the Yankee fleet from the 1800s. It's sort of hard to read the scale, but the bottom curve there is oil production from the 1800s, and you'll see peak whale oil. And you'll also notice what happened at the cost above it, that as peak whale oil hit, the whale oil went into really expense. And I stuck a little quote there on the lower right from a couple economists who worked with the Federal Reserve, and they had, this paper has been cited a whole lot, and they had asked the question, we sort of see every time there's an oil price shock, we have a pretty good chance of getting a recession. And there's a lot of people been writing articles recently on just how expensive it is that we don't know what the price of oil will be, that it keeps going up and down. And they looked at the particular question, is that real? And they said, well, yeah, actually it is. The mere fact that we're dealing with a scarce resource that fluctuates has big costs associated with it that hurt the economy. So we get a huge value out of energy, but we do see that as things get scarce, that their prices do weird things, and their prices doing weird things really do seem to hurt. So there's a background. So if you now click to slide 5, you know, I come from Pennsylvania. The European settlers got here, and they promptly deforested the whole thing. And then they said, oh, well, you know, we'll buy things from out of state. We hit peak whale oil, and they said, well, we'll use real oil. Pennsylvania oil mostly has been gone for a while. Now we're fracking for gas. So we're back in the heart of things here 100 years after last we were in the heart of things. But we do have this history that we get on an energy source, we use it until it becomes scarce, until the price goes up, and until we don't know what to do next, and then we start looking around for something next. 85% of our energy use in round numbers is fossil fuels. We're going to use them in a few hundred years. Nature spent a few hundred million years setting them aside, so we're using them a million times faster than nature set them aside. This is not sustainable in any possible way. You've probably heard TV commercials, you know, gas is going to be the solution. We will frack our way out for more than a century. The published estimates I've seen are sort of up to a century or so of gas at current rate of use, which is sort of a quarter of our energy use. So the estimates that I've run across that are out there go from maybe 25 years of energy use down to as few as 5 years or less from this new gas fracking. So it's a huge amount of money. It's a huge thing that's coming. But in terms of is there anything sustainable in a gas fracking, you can see the numbers that people who look at our energy system say it would take 30 years to make a big change. And if we simply built a gas system, the estimates are that we'd be out of gas before we could actually have that system built. So in terms of it might be a bridge to the future, it might make a difference, but in terms of does gas fracking somehow make us sustainable, don't kid anybody. Click forward to slide 6, and this is really, I think, the big point that comes out, is that we have to change. And the question is, do we start changing? Do we start learning? Do we get the feet on the ground and know how to do things while we still have a bit of a cushion before we run out of the fossil fuels or not? And so I'm going to walk you through what you all know very, very well, but it's probably worth seeing it once again. If we burn and then we learn, we're going to change the climate in ways that makes our grandchildren's lives and their grandchildren's lives a lot harder. We're going to risk the big price shocks, and we have to do it anyway. And that there really are paths that if we learn while we burn, we can get to a better economy and better jobs and national security and so on and so forth. And to be perfectly honest, there's a huge amount of science to be done. There's a huge amount of engineering to be done. There are new companies. There are patents. There are fortunes to be made. But there's not really anything in science and engineering that is a fundamental barrier to doing this. It really, you are much more important than the scientists and the engineers at this point, to be really honest about it. And if you remember the quote from Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us. At any rate, that comes to mind. So click on forward. Things that we're on 7 now. It's got a picture of a horse at the top. Just a few things that we bring up in the first show, just to remind people of what the story is. Is CO2 rising? Yes. Are we the main cause? Yes. Is there any serious question about that? None whatsoever. And we had a lot of fun filming down at Rotorua, which is what you see in the lower right there in New Zealand, on how do we know that it's human CO2 that's causing the rise. And we walk through, you know, first of all, it's simply the bookkeeping. How much fossil fuel we burn is just flabbergasting. The oil companies, the coal companies are so good at what they do that we just don't quite realize it. And I've got the numbers there in the upper right that a car is putting out a pound of CO2 per mile for a typical car on a typical U.S. road. And if the cars actually were to package their waste the way it used to be packaged, as horse ploppies, the amount of CO2 that we produce in a year, if you take that and condense it to the density of horse ploppies and spread it uniformly on all the roads in America, it would be an inch deep in a year. And we would not be having this discussion because everyone would see it, everybody would know it, and we would be having some other discussion. But at any rate, the bookkeeping, we know how much CO2 is coming out. We know that the source from the natural volcanoes, which looks very spectacular there behind me in the picture, is actually trivial compared to us, sort of 1% to be best number. And we spent a while in the first show, Jeff got some really great animations and things together, on how there are tracers in the atmosphere that confirm this. Volcanoes make CO2 by melting. That doesn't use oxygen. Fires make CO2 by burning. That uses oxygen. And so the rise in CO2 actually goes with a fall in oxygen. And then the changes in carbon-13, carbon-14 as well. There's really no discussion. We are raising CO2. It's us. If you flip to the next one, you know, I had this experience a small number of years ago where a staff member in Congress is telling me that global warming was based on hockey sticks. And I said, no, global warming is based on physics. And it's based on physics that the Air Force helped figure out. And this staff member was very confident about the hockey sticks and did not quite know what to do with physics, because staff members often are not trained in discussion of physics. At any rate, this is always a useful place to go. And Jeff found some great film clips of what actually was going on with the Air Force right after World War II. They were not doing global warming, but CO2 blocks the view from a heat-seeking missile. And the same way that it's blocking the heat from the enemy exhaust, it's blocking the heat going up from the Earth. And it's just physics. I've got the little chart on the left there. Every day there are satellites sitting up there in space confirming the greenhouse effect. It's just, you know, there's no hockey sticks in this. They show up. They're interesting. They're useful. They're important in some ways. But in terms of why we believe in the greenhouse effect, it's just physics. And really, there's nobody can argue with that. There's nothing to go from there. So at any rate, and a pretty picture of an old jet firing a heat-seeking missile there. Okay, so next one, picture 9, I'm going to walk you very briefly through something here. You may have seen something similar that came out at about the same time on Skeptical Science. A few other people have done this. This next little series of slides may be as important thing as anything that we have to deal with as educators. There's a vast number of people that have succeeded in fooling themselves. And you can demonstrate this if you go down to any large casino and watch people who think they have figured out what's coming up next on the roulette wheel. It's very easy for us to fool ourselves, and there are a whole lot of people down at the casino waving wads of money around who think that they know what the roulette wheel or the slot machine is going to do next. some of those people are also apparently down at Wall Street. But so at any rate, I'm going to show you here very briefly. I have a picture here, slide 9. The red in each case is the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies history of surface temperature of the planet. So red is global average surface temperature. Black is a regression line put through that little segment. And the words are highlights of my particular life. And so I was born in 1957. You can figure out that I'm old and gray and balding. But you can also see from the regression line that I was born at the start of an interval of cooling. Now, if you click to slide 10, I was fortunate to marry a wonderful woman to whom I'm still married in 1980. And you can see that the first years of our life together, it was getting colder. If you click to slide 11, we actually got this great job here at Penn State in 1988, and there's a very slight downward trend in the years that I just showed you there. It's the start of a cooling when we moved here. Slide 12 will show you that when we decided to take the kids out west to show them the great national parks, that it was getting colder. And slide 13, you'll see that they actually named a glacier in Antarctica after me, and it was really getting cold then. You could see it very clearly. And slide 14, our daughter came to Penn State to be a student, and it was getting very slightly colder. And so if you click to slide 15, you can see how I've lived my whole life in a time it was getting colder. And this is, unfortunately, if you go out on the web and start searching global warming stopped in 1998 or something like that, you will find hundreds of thousands of hits that people have done exactly what I just did. They pick a particular starting date, they pick a particular window, and then they try to convince themselves that there's no such thing as global warming. And this really goes on, and it's still going on. It was in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year in the editorial page. It was in some of the British papers earlier this year. This one is one that just doesn't die, and it will never die, because it should be evident that during this time of very strong warming, that it is absolutely easy to do this. You may have seen there was a piece on, may have been Skeptical Science, if you watch a person walking a dog, if you watch the dog, that's the red line, and if you watch the person, that's the blue line, and it's really easy to focus on the dog and not the person. And like I say, I think the Wall Street and I think a lot of casinos are just like this. But is it actually getting warmer? Yes, it is actually getting warmer. Is there any serious doubt about this? No, there really isn't. And if you click to slide 16, I think it's a very important point, and one that I got to make when we were filming by sitting in the boat in front of the glacier at the Tasman. But at any rate, you use thermometers, and it's getting warmer. And if you ask NOAA, they say it's getting warmer. If you ask NASA, they say it's getting warmer. If you ask the Brits, they say it's getting warmer. If you ask Berkeley, they say it's getting warmer. If you throw away the thermometers in the cities, just use the ones out in the country, they say it's getting warmer. If you don't like thermometers in the air, you don't trust them, just use the ones in the ocean, they say it's getting warmer. You can put your thermometer in a hole in the ground, it says it's getting warmer. You look at the ones taken aloft on radio suns, they say it's getting warmer. You look at the ones looking down from satellites, and it doesn't matter if it's done by RSS or if it's done by the Alabama Huntsville Group, they say it's getting warmer. You look at the temperature-sensitive parts of snow and ice, the seasonal snow, the frozen ground, seasonally frozen ground, permanently frozen ground, river ice, lake ice, they show it getting warmer. You look at where things live and when they do things, and they show it getting warmer. And this is something that it's usually very hard to get people to sit through this much of a recitation, but it's something that I think that really our listeners don't often get, our students don't often get, that when a big result is brought forward in public by the scientific community, there's no name attached to it. There's no data set attached to it. There is nothing that you could throw away one piece of information that would change the picture in any way. That when the scientific community actually brings forward a result, it is supported in so many independent ways that are woven together so strongly that finding a mistake doesn't matter anymore, because there's so much more support for the statement. And I think this is one in particular where you can see it very well, that you simply, if you find that somewhere in that NOAA data set there's a thermometer that wasn't very good, it makes no difference. It really is getting warmer with really very high confidence. Okay, so if we click ahead a little more, 17, of course, probably the biggest question is the warming really related to the human-caused CO2? And this one is one that's really hard to explain, but the simple answer is yes, the warming is related to the human CO2 with very high confidence. The plot is a complicated thing from IPCC, and in each panel, the black is the history of temperature, the blue is what nature did, and the pink is what nature plus humans did. And it's clear that the recent trends are not explainable by nature alone. We very often get the question, well, so it's part nature and part humans, right? Isn't it, you know, well, probably the best answer is that the warming from our greenhouse gases is actually bigger than 100%. If anything, nature has tried to cool it off a little bit. We have tried to cool it off by blocking the sun with our particles, and despite us and nature trying to cool it off, it's gotten warmer. And so if you really wanted to sort of pick what's the best estimate for the warming effect of the CO2, it's more than everything that's happened. And that's probably worth keeping in mind. Clicking ahead again, 18, and this is, I think, again, a very important issue. The changes so far are scientifically unequivocal. They are big enough that we can check our scientific understanding and realize that it does very well, but they're not immense to people who haven't been paying attention. If you live inside and you're not a gardener and you don't jog to work, you may not have noticed a huge amount of change yet, but the changes so far are very small compared to what's coming under business as usual based on that solid scientific understanding. And so if we keep doing what we're doing, we've validated the science well enough to know that what's coming people will notice with fairly high confidence. Okay. So clicking ahead then, number 19, something that Jeff did, I think, very well in making the TV show. This issue often becomes so politicized in the U.S. that some of the spokespeople that you could use don't carry weight with some of the audience that you might talk to. And so one of the ways forward is to find unexpected spokespeople who nonetheless understand and honestly speak to the issues. And I have to admit, Rear Admiral Titley now has a different position, so he is no longer oceanographer of the Navy, but he was when we did this.
Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, yes?
Richard, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, your speaking got all broken up, and I wasn't sure if other people were having trouble hearing you.
I didn't have any trouble.
Sounds fine to me.
Loud and clear.
Okay,
all clear.
Sorry for interrupting, man. Go ahead.
No, thank you, please. If there's any problem, please whistle. So, at any rate, so Rear Admiral Tetley, at the point in the first show where I would show up and say, wow, you might want to think about this, Rear Admiral Tetley shows up and says, wow, you might want to think about this. And the quotes from the Pentagon are very clear and very powerful. You know, that's the Pentagon deals in the real world. And they, every time something breaks, we ask them to fix it. And they look out there and say that we're going to see more things break, and you're going to ask us to fix more things. And you ought to know that, and you ought to be thinking about it. And so the quotes from them really are indeed very powerful. There's also a lot that they're doing about it. So 19 there. If we click ahead then to 20, this is, again, where you come in as being so important is in the communication of these issues. And what I have shown up here on 20 is a what we would call a probability density function. But what I have shown here is what a commuter faces. So I am a fortunate person. I ride my bicycle or I jog. But I do know people who have to drive, and I actually know people who have to drive in Washington, D.C. and other hideous places like that. And if you're a commuter, you get in the car and you say, what do I expect? I expect to get stuck in traffic and I won't have much fun listening to the radio. You say, well, couldn't it be better than that? Maybe it's Columbus Day and there's no traffic and they're doing the Beach Boys Festival. Yeah, it could happen. Not very likely, but it's possible. Couldn't it be worse than that? You know, there's an accident up ahead. You get stuck in traffic for a long time. You know, the emergency broadcast system passed, blah, blah. Yeah, that could happen. And couldn't you get run over by a drunk driver? And what we expect when we get in a car, what we think is going to happen is almost the best that's possible. It's way over there on the good end. And there's a very long tail out on the bad end. And if you click to the next one, what we do about that is we put a reasonable fraction of our transportation budget into that very long tail out on the bad end. And so we buy airbags and crumpled zones and anti-lock brakes and seat belts and child seats and insurance and Mothers Against Drunk Driving support. And, you know, we really do put money into something that we really don't expect to happen because of the slight chance that it will get bad. And you know the analogy, you may have seen it, but if you click the next one, we have an estimate of the challenges facing us from climate change. And yes, it's possible that things will be better than that. And it's possible that they'll be worse, but it's also possible that something really bad will happen. And if you saw the Sherwood and Huber paper, they say we might make it so that an unair-conditioned human can't live in large parts of the planet. That's not what we expect at this point, but it's the drunk driver. And the last few times that I've been to Congress, there's been an argument between the blue and the green. And we have not been having much of the argument between the red and the magenta on this one. And so it's an interesting thing going on here. So, at any rate, if we click ahead then, the rest of the Earth the Operator's Manual, the second and third shows in particular, are looking at the, are we doomed or is there a way out of this? And this is, we're not doomed at all. This is very straightforward. The total amount of energy that we're using today is about 15 terawatts across humanity, you know, a few thousand watts per person. And the total amount of energy that's available to us simply dwarfs that. And so if we click ahead to 24, I just love this picture. I don't remember if Jeff took this one or if Art Howard took this one, but I just truly love this one. And so you should be looking at a bunch of cattle standing around next to the wind turbines in West Texas. And before the Civil War, Abe Lincoln is going around giving a talk on how science and engineering can help people. And as part of that talk, he's got this impassioned plea that we should capture the wind. And he says we got to harness the wind. And a number of other things he was interested in as well. But you can see the quote there. Well, we did. And by not that much after the Civil War, we had an industry of building wind turbines. And if you click to the next one, you know, if we go and build out a wind farm on the places that it's easy to do, go out on the plains, go out on the deserts, build the wind farm where it's windy, that actually would generate more energy than humanity uses. And it's something that Jeff are going to have some absolutely fantastic film of what this is doing for the people in West Texas and the towns that were dying that are now coming back to life. The people that got through the drought, maybe the crop failed, but each of those wind turbines was $10,000 for them that year. And if they've got a couple of dozen of them up there, that pays for the farm and the rancher doesn't go under. And so it's money for them. It really is pulling money out of thin air. And they actually get mad that we're not doing more wind, because every once in a while they look out the window and the turbine isn't going because there's nobody to buy the electricity. And when they look out the window and the turbine isn't going, their check just got smaller. So we used to be big in wind. We certainly could do it again. And if you click one more, here's another wind picture, 26. It's got one of the old windmills and one of the new ones. It's a little hard to find out exactly how many windmills we were building 100 years ago, but in round numbers, if we built them as fast now as we built them then, in the 30 years that it sort of takes to change the energy system, we would be generating a large fraction of the world's energy just from wind. So in terms of, is this sort of impossible? Is it too big to do? Is this something we can't get ourselves wrapped around? Of course not. This is something that is eminently doable. Click one more forward in the obligatory sun picture. I'm sure many of you have seen some version of this picture at some point. Can one do sun? Yes. Is there enough energy available to do sun? Yes. Are there any serious problems? Not really. There are people say things that are wrong about albedo modification and stuff, but basically, is it possible to do sun in a way that works? Yes, it is. So click ahead to number 28. We had a little fun here doing how you might capture sun, which involved me getting to go out in that lift basket that you see up there, and I'm showing how concentrated solar thermal works. It worked. An inventor named Frank Schumann was running steam engines on the sun in Philadelphia 100 years ago. It certainly worked then. It certainly can work now. Click ahead just a little more, a couple other things that we had fun with. Picture 29 here is me back at Rotorua and also at a geothermal power plant that is New Year's Day down in New Zealand. And there's certainly a lot of power if we get smart in how one can do geothermal. It's something that can be, you can drill the hole and make it hot and then just turn it off for now and let it sit there until you need it, and then you can open the valve and make it work if you really feel like it. If you click to 30, we had fun filming at NREL, National Renewable Energy Lab. Truly wonderful place if you have a chance and want to tour somewhere. It is really exciting. I think there's a lot of us get very, very nervous about burning food for fuel in a hungry world, and NREL is trying to figure out how to burn things that are not food for fuel, and they're having a good bit of success on it there. Click to 31. It is worth pointing out, and I think Bill Nordhaus wrote this up just recently in response to the Wall Street Journal editorial. If you're an economist, and you believe that the economy can grow forever, and it can grow at 4% per year or something like that. So you are a traditional economist, and all you are is hard-nosed, and you're trying to optimize the marginal utility of consumption, you pay attention to this. And we often sort of get this idea around here that somehow the people who ignore money are paying attention, but the people who count money don't pay attention. But in fact, it's very clear from the economics, you pay attention to this if you just care about money and you believe it can grow forever. And I think that's really important to have, is that the traditional economic analyses say you pay attention to this. If we click to 32, of course, the Pentagon said, if you care about national security, you pay attention to this. The issue of jobs, the scholarship is still evolving. It's really hard to get a really strong statement out of anyone, but if there's a tendency in the published literature, it is that by switching away from fossil fuels, you end up with more jobs. And I've got a lot of the references in my book, and you can find them buried in the back. But it does look like you get as many and probably more jobs, with a very clear result that if you get started, you capture the export market and you end up better off. So the late adopters tend to lose. The early adopters tend to win. There is, of course, the golden rule issue. The people who lose are poor people in hot places and people who haven't been born yet. The people who win are the people who are causing the change now, and they're not losing very much. And so if you're really interested in the golden rule, you tend to respond to this. And so money says you respond, national security says respond, jobs probably say you respond, golden rule says you respond, and eventually you have to respond because there's no other option. And then if you click to the, I think this is the last one here, and one of the truly beautiful places that I've ever seen, Jeff took me in filming there, this is the mouth of the Nile River Cave on the South Island of New Zealand, and we were filming about better light sources by taking candles and flashlights and LEDs down to look at New Zealand glowworms. But for what it's worth, can we have a sustainable future? Sure. Can we have a better economy, more jobs, greater security, and the golden rule? Yes, we can, if we decide to do it. And so that's really what the TV is about. I think that is exactly what all of you are about. I think that's why this particular phone-in is going on. And so thank you for inviting me, and I'll shut up and answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Richard. This is really a great presentation. I'll ask for questions, but first I'll ask the first one. Have you had success when you're having discussions with people who don't really believe it? Does your discussion along these lines have an impact on their thinking, or are they pretty much closed-minded about considering anything?
Yeah, it's highly variable. It's the big difficulty is that as soon as you if you're in public, the public interactions almost always control it. So if you're talking to your neighbor or your congressperson or what have you, and there's a bunch of people around listening, they have positions that they've taken that they're sort of expected to support, and it gets very, very hard to change this. I have had bizarrely different conversations with elected officials in public versus in private. And in private, it truly is wonderful. I think that most of them are actually smart. I think most of them actually want to do the right thing. And in public, they're on script. And that script is pretty strange sometimes. And so there is this that getting to everybody is almost impossible, but getting to each individual may be possible if there's enough of us who are getting there. I've had people will send me the email that says, you're an evil person who ought to burn for doing this, and I send back an email that says, I'm a person. And their next one is, oh my goodness, you're not them. And then you can have a discussion. And so, again, it comes back to you, ultimately, which is that what we did with the TV show, what Jeff did, what I tried to do is to find the right stories. But we're going to get them as far as you. You're going to take them to your neighbor. You're going to take them to your congressperson. You're going to take them to someone else, because this really is going to involve a whole lot of us in small group, one-on-one discussions.
Okay, great. Are there other questions?
This is Alan Gould out in Berkeley. I had a question about the slide. This is sort of a question about message. The slide about, first of all, thanks. This is a wonderful presentation. I got a lot out of it.
Good.
In the slide where you're talking about that it's just physics and the hockey stick, it sounded to me like you weren't really relating to temperature, although the greenhouse effect is intrinsically related to temperature, but the hockey stick is temperature. All the graphs of hockey stick are about temperature.
Absolutely.
And the increase in CO2 is not exactly a hockey stick. So I'm wondering, it's not just physics. I mean, it is physics, but I'm wondering if it's a little bit misleading.
Yeah, I would start the question: why do we expect warming from CO2? There's a huge number of people that don't really get that, and they often do sort of have this mental idea that we see CO2 going up, we see temperature going up, so it must be that we're just putting those two together and saying CO2 warms. And so I think it's really important for us to start that, why do we expect CO2 to affect the climate? It's physics. Why do we expect it? It's physics. It's physics, it's physics, it's physics. It's physics that's observed every day. It's a physics observed by satellite. It's physics that's done in the lab. It's physics that we can't get away from. There's no way that you can crank up the CO2 without having a warming influence, without turning up the thermostat on the planet, because the physics simply don't allow anything else. This is, you drop the pen and it falls down. And if somebody wants to go past that, if we were sitting here looking at each other, and I hold out my pen, so I'm holding out my pen right now. If I dropped this pen, it might go up if you had a gymongous electromagnet that sucked it up at the moment that I dropped it. And it might go up if a tornado came through and took the roof off at the moment that I dropped it. And it might go up if a giant earthquake happened at the moment I dropped it and dropped the building by 3 feet. But you know it's going to go down. And CO2 causing warming is really sort of the same thing. It is is straightforward physics that, yes, if we turn up CO2 and at the exact same moment there's 42 gymongous volcanic eruptions that block the sun, it will get cooler for a little while. But does CO2 have a warming influence? Yeah, it's physics. And I think it's really important to get away from this idea that somehow we came to this through correlations, because we certainly didn't come through this through correlations. Is that getting towards what you were asking?
Yeah, it is. I was just I was concerned about the phrase, it's not the hockey stick. But it is.
Well,
start talking about the hockey stick.
Right. The hockey stick is, of course, a very funny thing. And I wrote this up in a chapter in the book. And even in our community, you'll have different people that sort of view the hockey stick in different ways. What my man was really trying to do, as I understand it, in doing what now is known as the hockey stick, was to simply get rid of the global signal so that he could see the regional changes. And you ask the interesting question, if the volcano happens, does it tend to favor La Nina or does it tend to favor El Nino? Well, the volcano has an overall global cooling effect. You need to throw away that overall effect to see the regional pattern. And so the original intent of the hockey stick, a lot of it, was simply to find the global signal so you could throw it away. The fascinating thing, this is absolutely fascinating, is that one of the key questions that we face is, what is the climate sensitivity? If we double CO2, let the world come in balance, how much warmer is it? And you probably know there's a huge number of ways that people can estimate the climate sensitivity. A lot of it is from what is needed, what comes out of the physics. A lot of it is what would be needed to build a model that looks like the modern Earth. A lot of it is what would be needed to explain how hot it was in the Cretaceous or the Pliocene or how cold it was during the Ice Age. And so there's a number of different ways to do this. People have tried doing it matching the last 100 years. That's very difficult because we don't know the effect of particles on clouds. People have tried to do it matching the last 1,000 years. Now, if you take Mann's curve, the hockey stick as originally published, and you try to say, okay, what does that say about climate sensitivity? What it says is that we don't have a huge concern because the sensitivity is pretty small because the change from medieval to Little Ice Age was pretty small in that reconstruction. So the sun changed, the volcanoes changed, and you ask, how much did the climate change? And in that particular reconstruction, the climate change was not terribly big in response to the forcings. Now, we believe that the amplifiers, the feedbacks in the climate system, amplify everything. You put warmer air over the ocean, and it picks up more water vapor, and it doesn't care whether the air is warmer because of a brighter sun or because of more CO2 or because of space alien rays. You know, warmer air picks up more. So if those natural changes are small, then the future warming is fairly small. Now, Mann's original paper had such large uncertainties about the hockey stick that, in fact, it doesn't provide a strong constraint on climate sensitivity, but his central estimate was global warming is not as important a thing as you might think. And so if you simply took the hockey stick, apply it to climate sensitivity, and ask what does that say about our future, it reduces your concern about global warming. Work since has said, no, the climate change was towards the higher end of the uncertainties in the Mann reconstruction. That's consistent with other indications. We have more concern. So now do this. The political thing has been Mann made the medieval warm period small. Therefore, Mann is cheating to try to make you worry about climate change. But in fact, that makes you less worried about climate change. The people that have been criticizing him either have no idea what they're talking about or they're deliberately telling you something that's wrong, because that small natural change would be called small climate sensitivity, and we now think that the change is a little bigger, and so the sensitivity is a little bigger. And that one's too long. I can do that with you. I couldn't do that with a lot of people because it's too long a story. But if anything, the hockey stick was optimistic.
Are there other questions?
I have one quick comment, if I may. This is Kathy Ellens at the Institute for Geophysics at UT Austin. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Doing great. How about you?
Good.
Mickey, hear it out?
Hello?
Yes.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, Kathy.
So, Tamara, as you know, and Richard, you may not know, but we are preparing a number of teachers here to give professional development on climate this summer for Earth Labs, which is a project that's led, curriculum development project led by Tamara. And we had Carrie Cook in to give a presentation. She actually spent about 3 hours with our 8 teachers. And what she talked about was exactly this topic that has come up, the physics of why CO2 is so concerning to us. And it was I couldn't believe that somebody going through 8 pages of equations and complicated graphs could be of such interest to our teachers, but it absolutely was wonderful. And I just wanted to comment that it really enhanced our understanding
outstanding
of the issue. So
that's great. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, this is Carol Mandrick. I'd just like to make a quick comment.
Okay. Yep.
Go ahead. I'd just like to say that I've heard you talk before, and you're always amazing, but I must say that your I've ever heard. And you're right that it's a little bit complicated have you ever sort of written that little blurb up somewhere? If it was somewhere on a blog or something.
I'm sorry. There's somebody talking over you at this point.
Yes.
I don't quite know what happened, but I didn't hear all of that.
Could I just ask that whoever is speaking offline, please mute your phone.
Can you hear me now? Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead and ask your question again.
Okay, I just wanted to say that your explanation of the misunderstandings about the hockey stick and Michael Mann's original intent, et cetera, is one of the clearest I've ever heard, which doesn't surprise me coming from you. And I think it would be wonderful if that could be written down in a blog entry or something that we could then refer other people to, because it was just so crystal clear.
Well, thank you. And I will take that seriously. It's in the book, but, of course, that's paywalled. So I will take that seriously. I'm not sure how fast it will happen, but I think that's a great idea, and thank you.
Okay, so I'll ask you that when you do that, if you could let me know, or you can just send it to the Climate Literacy Network yourself, or I can forward it on to everybody so that we can share that around.
Great, thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Joel Rosenberg from Berkeley. And in this discussion about CO2 and people not appreciating the outsized impact that it has, I've heard Bob Sokolow talk about how one of the big stories about climate change is that humans can actually affect the atmosphere, which is something that for many years scientists and the general public, I think, didn't think was possible. And I'm just curious about the communication around the fact that 390 parts per million is actually 0.039% of the atmosphere, and just how that small amount and how it is in our power to double it is possible, combined with the fact that it does act like a blanket, and so we're basically going to put another blanket on the atmosphere.
Right. So 0.039, if it was blood alcohol content, you're drunk in Europe and you can still drive in the U.S., but you're impaired. And when we double it, you're going to be a drunk driver in the U.S. And that may be a place to go. You can go to poisons, which is in some poisons at 0.039, you're dead. But I sort of like the drunk driving one. But we do, and you know this. We get a lot of people that believe that humanity cannot change the atmosphere. And so I think it's really important that we somehow keep finding lots of ways to do this. And we, in the TV show, Jeff got some animations of actually the Ice Age roller coaster, and we're going through CO2 changing in the Ice Ages from 180 to 280 to 180 to 280, and then it goes up to 380, and he's got a little animated me riding this roller coaster, and then the animated me goes bungee jumping. But the point is, very well taken, that some people just get this, and you tell them, you know, you do the science, you figure it out. Some people do sort of think that, you know, when you're 2 years old and you're in a diaper and you do something in the diaper, they have to change you. But if you just release some gas, it just blows away and it's gone. And so all our gas just blows away and it's gone, so it can't matter, can it? And this is a real challenge for us as communicators, as educators, to sort of make this visible to people. If it came out so we could see it, we would not be having this call.
Okay, are there any other questions? We are just at the end of our hour, but I'll take one more question if there's any. Okay, well, if not, I'll thank you very much, Richard. It was a very, very interesting discussion. The recording of the presentation along with the slides will be posted on the Climate Literacy Network website, so that if you want give the other people the opportunity to hear Richard's talk and see his slides, you can point them to there. And it should be up there within a day.
Hey, and thank you all so much. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow.